18740 CV Mattson versus Marsh and McLean and Texas Civil Commitment Office. And whenever you're ready, sir.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. My name is William Marshall. I'm here on behalf of Gerald Mattson today. Mr. Mattson is a 68-year-old man. He has two convictions for offenses with, he has a conviction for two offenses of indecency with a child by contact. He completed his 15-year prison sentence, and prior to his completing that sentence, he was ordered into indefinite Health and Safety Code, Chapter 841, civil commitment. That happened in January of 2014. For a year and a half, he lived in a halfway house in Houston. And during that time, he was allowed, because of his progress in treatment and his behavior, to go out into the community with no more supervision than a GPS monitor. For the last 3.5 years, he's been forced to live in a repurposed private prison in Littlefield, Texas, for which he has given the pleasure or the honor of paying to live there. This is the second case that I'm aware of in which residents of the Texas Civil Commitment Center have challenged Texas Civil Commitment Office rules and complained about the ultra vires acts of the executive director, and contended that the Civil Commitment Office and its executive director violated the resident's constitutional rights. Both of those cases were instituted pro se, and the plaintiffs asked me to come in to help them. Throughout both of those cases, the state has asserted sovereign immunity by way of plea to the jurisdiction. Now, in the first suit, we had seven amended petitions trying to get allegations that that did what the state said that they should have done. We've only had two amended petitions in this case. Being new to administrative law and to sovereign immunity in particular, I was confused about why the pleas of the jurisdiction seemed to argue that the trial court had to delve into the merits of the case in order to evaluate its subject matter jurisdiction. And I was especially confused because Travis County district courts are required by law to hear administrative rule challenges. I was also confused because it seemed like the Administrative Procedures Act was pretty clear about what needs to be alleged in order to bring a rule challenge case, and that it clearly and unequivocally waived immunity from suit to those rule challenges.
So can I interrupt you, Mr. Yes, Marshall? Ma'am. What rules of the APA are you specifically challenging?
We're not challenging any APA rules. We're challenging rules that are in Title 37, Chapter 810, of the administrative code. Those are the rules for the Texas Civil Commitment Office.
Right, and I've seen there was a broad statement in your briefing that says all proclamations in 810 are invalid because they were adopted, blah, blah, blah.
Yes.
You're attacking the entirety of 810?
We're alleging that all of those rules are invalid, but for purposes of this case, we're focused on two of the rules that are one each of the definition, and the other one is a rule that specifies that the residents have to pay 33% or not more than 50% of their income to cover or to pay part of the cost of their GPS monitoring, their housing, and their treatment. Those are the three specific rules that we're challenging for purposes of this case.
So you're not saying that they didn't engage in a proper rulemaking process, or you are saying that?
We're saying that the Texas Civil Commitment Office, the entity with rulemaking authority, did not adopt those rules. The board governing the Texas Civil Commitment Office adopted those rules. We've got in the record a copy of the board, the minutes of the board meeting from the Texas Civil Commitment, the board, showing where they adopted those rules.
So I'm having a little difficulty understanding your differentiation between the TCCO and the board of the TCCO.
They're entirely separate entities created separately. They were actually created back in 2011 when the legislature separated the Office of Violent Sex Offender Management, which became the Texas Civil Commitment Office, out of the Council on Sex Offender Treatment. The Council on Sex Offender Treatment had a board that, actually, I don't think they even had a board. They were given rule authority. When they spun the Office of Violent Sex Offender Management out of the Council on Sex Offender Treatment, they created a board to govern the Office of Violent Sex Offender Management.
So the board doesn't govern this TCCO?
It does govern it, but it does not have rulemaking authority. Chapter 841 of the Texas Health and Safety Code, which is the civil commitment of sexually violent predators, in section 841.141, specifically instructs the Texas Civil Commitment Office to administer the chapter by rule.
And it would be done by whom at the TCCO?
Well, they've got an executive director, they've got a general counsel, they've got other officers.
They would make the rules.
They would make the rules. And my definition of governing means the board makes sure that the office does what it's supposed to do and doesn't do what it's not supposed to do. In 840 Health and Safety Code 841.002, office is given a specific definition, and that is the Texas Civil Commitment Office. 141 says the office shall administer this chapter by rule. Now, for a period of time, including when this lawsuit was filed, there was a subsection B in there that specifically required the office to adopt a specific set of rules. After this lawsuit was filed, the legislature deleted that section requiring those specific rules, but there was 2 years where the office had the duty to adopt those rules, to adopt those specific sets of rules. They didn't adopt those rules. If they had, those rules would have given probably a lot of guidance to the residents of the Civil Commitment Center about what was expected of them, what they needed to do, how they could progress through treatment and eventually get released from the program.
And so I don't want to get ahead of you, so if you want to back up, feel free, but because the rules were not properly enacted, that's what leads to your ultra vires claims, is because these fees and things like that were assessed without the proper rulemaking procedure in place?
They were.
And that's how your ultra vires acts?
The ultra vires claim, in my mind, is completely separate from just the fact that the rules are invalid.
Okay.
We go over here and we look to see what the executive director or the civil commitment office was given authority to do. Among the things that they weren't given authority to do was adopt a definition for indigence that's different from Chapter 841.005 and 841.141. The legislature says that a person subject to a civil commitment proceeding under this chapter, if they're indigent, gets represented by State Counsel for Offenders. Mr. Mattson was represented by State Counsel for Offenders at trial. He's been represented by State Counsel for Offenders at his biennial reviews.
Yeah, but once indigent, not always indigent.
Well,
so that's probably not your strongest argument.
My argument on that issue follows along because under 841.084, the people are only responsible for paying those cost recovery fees if they are indigent. So the legislature gave no indication that they meant indigent to be different in 005 than they meant for it to be in 141. So in order for her to make a definition of indigent that's different from the legislature intended.
Well, but that's not different. Indigence, your status can change over the course of time given your financial income.
And
that's not a difference in the definition of the word indigence.
On that issue, Mr. Mattson's judgment did not, at the time his judgment was entered, the statute did not require payment for housing and treatment.
Sure.
It only required payment of some portion of GPS
sure.
monitoring.
Agreed.
Subsequently, the legislature changed the statute to impose the duty to pay for housing and treatment. Mm-hmm. His judgment ordered the state to pay for his treatment and supervision. It denied him, or denied all relief not granted in there. The judgment did not order him to pay GPS. So res judicata covers the issue of whether he would ever have to pay GPS because the judgment denied the state the right to that relief. Res judicata comes in additionally when the judgment says, state, you have to pay for his treatment and supervision. Treatment is one of the two things that they added in 2015, treatment and housing being the other one. He's in the Civil Commitment Center for supervision because Executive Director McLean takes the position that he has to be in total confinement because it's needed for his...
The tiered system.
Right. Well, for his treatment and supervision.
Right.
So the judgment...
I just want to alert you. You are cutting into your time for the end. We didn't cut other people off because they were at the end of their time, but you still have other time that you might want to...
Okay. So can I touch quickly on...
You can. Absolutely.
Okay. Mr. Mattson has three basic types of claims: the Administrative Procedures Act claim, the ultra vires claims, and the constitutional violation claims. When a court is evaluating whether it has subject matter jurisdiction under a plea of the jurisdiction, it's supposed to, number one, consider the intent of the pleader. It's supposed to interpret the allegations liberally in favor of jurisdiction. And under the general pleading rules, it's supposed to interpret allegations to do significant justice or substantial justice. All of Mr. Mattson's allegations on each of the three various claims fall within the subject matter jurisdiction of a court of general jurisdiction when it's his intent under the three different petitions, the
I don't want you to waste your time. I don't think anyone disputes that a Travis County District Court does not have the ability to hear those types of claims. It's just whether or not they can in this instance.
Oh, okay.
You're welcome to continue. But I think this court does know that those are the types of cases that Travis County District Courts hear.
The case that was just up here before us was one of those. So, just one other point that when I was trying to figure out why it appeared that the pleas of the jurisdiction indicated that the court needed to look into the merits of the case, that's when I found out that the difference between claiming immunity from suit and immunity from liability. Immunity from liability is not the proper subject of a plea of the jurisdiction. According to Wichita Falls State Hospital versus Taylor. So.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. There are six categories of claims listed in Mattson's second amended petition, and these sets of claims are set out in the court's order at pages 382 at 382 and 383 of the record. One of the six claims, and that's a claim alleging that TECO has created a debtor's prison, is unbriefed and is therefore waived. I'm going to focus my argument on two of these sets of claims, the work program pay and the rule challenge claims. If time allows, I will also address the ultra-virus claims, but I'm happy to answer questions on any of the issues before the court. I'm going to start with the claims that the trial court actually retained, and those are the due process and the takings clause claims regarding work program pay. And in my briefing, I provided a link that just kind of basically described what the work program was at the TCCC. Unfortunately, that link no longer works.
That was going to be one of my questions. What is the link that we could use?
I apologize for that, Your Honor. However, the information contained in that, such as the amount of pay, the limitations on how many hours a week a person can work, what they do. Mr. Mattson, I believe, is a dishwasher, and that information can be found in Mattson's own description of the program, which is at 54 of the record.
Okay, so we don't have a link
anymore. The link does not work. I tried to find the replacement of it. I'm not sure if it's our security system where I can't get on it anymore, or if the link's been moved. But
it's broken. It's broken.
Ours don't work. It's broken.
Mine does not work either. So,
but we can find the same information at page 54.
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. And I apologize for that. Also, at page 332 of the record, this is kind of the significant component of it, and it shows how the pay is distributed from the work program. It shows that 2/3 of it is given to Mattson, and 1/3 of it is given to TECO to fulfill Mattson's statutory obligations under 841.084 of the Texas Health and Safety Code. And that's a worksheet. The worksheet appears in several parts of the record. 332 is where Mattson's actually filled out his own information in it.
But that was kind of compelled, right? My understanding is he did not necessarily want to give all this information. Or no? Am I mistaken? Is this not that?
Your Honor, I do. He didn't want to provide the information and fill out the form to TECO. My understanding is that's probably true. I would also call the court's attention to the fact that he's also given most of the same information to the court when he filed the suit, and that is in the record as well. I don't have the exact page in front of me, but it's near the page 54 site that I just gave you.
Can I ask a question?
Of course, Your Honor.
Just kind of going somewhere different. I know that there's an argument that there was an amended, I guess, the Third Amendment.
Yes, Your Honor.
Before the trial judge, I guess, wrote her judgment. Is it your position, and I'll ask this when you get back up here, Mr. Marshall, that the breach of contract and the civil rights claims that were added, were those disposed of in the court's order and the court's judgment? Do you believe they were?
Your Honor, and this was the breach of contract with CCRS, and the civil rights, is that the right to assembly?
Yes, under first assembly.
I do not believe those were addressed.
Okay, so are those still in district court?
I believe they are, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
Turning to the due process claim, Mattson was given all the process he was due in his civil commitment hearings. He was subjected to the provisions of Chapter 841 of the Texas Health and Safety Code when he was declared an SVP. He was given a full hearing and a jury trial, and his original order of commitment appears at 138 and 139 of the record. Admittedly, this hearing took place when an old version of the statute was in place. In 2015, the legislature passed Senate Bill 746, which changed the SVP statute in some significant ways, adding the tiered treatment program and expanding the cost recovery program. But Mattson was not subjected to these requirements until his order of commitment was amended to reflect these legislative changes. He was given additional due process. He was present at this hearing. He was permitted to call witnesses. He was permitted to cross-examine witnesses. And an amended commitment order was entered. And all this information is at 140 and 141 of the record.
And Ms. Fuchs, I'm going to interrupt you again. Mr. Marshall had said that originally, I guess in 2014, when the only reimbursable or expense, if we can call it reimbursable, was the GPS tracking. that was not included in the judgment. Do you agree that the court has the discretion of ordering it or not ordering it?
I don't, Your Honor, because the Chapter 841 applies to all people who are declared SVPs. So that was automatically part of his commitment order.
So indigency is a red herring, or?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
So then does that mean that indigency is a red herring, or?
I believe it is, Your Honor, because indigency is something that's considered for each circumstance. If you're indigent for one purpose, that doesn't necessarily mean you're indigent for all purposes. And in fact, Mr. Mattson himself was declared to be not indigent for an appeal on his SVP status, and that case is cited in my briefing. You need to be unable to pay for the specific item in order to be considered indigent. And in fact, TICO's rules reflect that, because in a month where Mr. Mattson would happen to have no income for whatever reason, he would owe no money to TICO. And this is reflected in the worksheet at 332. You can see where there's a certain amount, and then you owe a third of that. So if that initial amount is zero, he owes nothing that month.
And so let's talk about that, because I agree. I think the law is that, you know, once indigent doesn't mean you're always indigent. But where do we get this monthly kind of, you know, we look at it monthly. Can you look at it weekly? Do you know where that comes from, or what authority it is to have the indigency status of a civilly committed person determined on a month-to-month basis?
Your Honor, I believe that it just comes from the general provision where TICO is giving the authority to implement this program through the legislature and make rules regarding the program. I don't believe that the legislature put any kind of requirement that we need to do this monthly, we need to do this. In fact, the rule is more specific in terms of, you know, it can't exceed 50%. So regardless of, you know, the rule says that regardless of what the policy is, you can never say we're going to take all an SVP's income, because it doesn't come close to paying, you know, what the actual expenses are. That's in rule. The rule also explicitly says that the amount that a SVP can owe in a particular month can't exceed the actual expenses. So, you know, if somebody inherits, you know, $1 million, they're not going to owe $1 million to TICO.
Does the rule say in a specific month?
The rule says that it's not to, I have it in front of me, I can.
And I'm just asking because you said in the given month, and I was wondering if the rule is, I didn't remember reading that it was that specific.
Actually, Your Honor, I do not believe that it does say in a specific month. I can tell you that from all my knowledge, that's the way that TICO has always administered the program, is on a month-to-month basis.
Okay. Are there other programs that are administered? Is that the way that it's usually done? Or do you know?
I'm not sure what, you know, what other programs would be done this way. It may be, you know, just related to, you know, they're getting paid on a monthly basis for the work they do in the program, as well as, you know, SVPs vary greatly in, you know, what sources of income they may have. So it's, okay. But in terms of, so when Mattson was declared an SVP, he was subjected to the statute governing the SVP program. And he's arguing now that he gets due process for individual elements of the program that he doesn't like, and that's just not the case. I was unable to find any law that specifically addresses this issue that Mattson raises about the work program pay. However, there are some cases that I believe are instructive on the issue. The Beaumont Court of Appeals has addressed some similar types of claims, not with regards to the payment aspect, but In re Cortez and In re May are both cited into my briefing. And in those cases, the SVP challenged a change in his residence, saying that his liberty interest was implicated. And the court said that the SVPs lost their rights to control their living arrangements when they were declared SVP. In Ray State, the petitioner was not entitled to counsel at a hearing amending his commitment order, even though significant changes were being made, because he was given the full panoply of due process at his initial hearing.
Is that the one that's at 556? Because in Ray State's kind of like a big...
I believe so, Your Honor.
Yeah,
that's
okay.
The one that
the
was...
The Supreme Court case?
Yes, okay. About this time last year.
Thank you.
I also wanted to talk about a case that is not cited in my brief. It's a federal Western District of Texas case, Going versus Morales, and I'll give you the cite to that. 2009 Westlaw 2382985. And this is a case involving the prison work program. And in that case, the inmates don't get paid at all. But there is a legislative requirement that they do participate in this program. And in this case, an inmate challenged this requirement under various constitutional theories, including due process. And the court concluded that Texas law mandates compulsory labor, so the requirement that the inmate participate in this program is an indistinguishable characteristic of plaintiff's sentence. Plaintiff's sentence automatically includes this requirement. Likewise, the cost recovery program is an indistinguishable characteristic of Mattson's commitment order, and his commitment order automatically includes this, the cost recovery program. And although these are slightly different programs, in both cases, the legislature created a set of rules that applied to people who were subjected to the rules by virtue of a court order. I also wanted to very briefly address, Mattson calls this cost recovery program both restitution and garnishment in his pleadings, and it's neither. It's not restitution because this money is not going to a victim. And it's not garnishment because, for a variety of reasons, significantly, Mattson is not a debtor for purposes of this program. Again, he only owes what he can pay each month. So when this a third of the income he earned for a particular month is taken out of his paycheck, it's not going to pay a debt. It's going to fulfill his statutory obligation for that particular month. Turning to the takings claims, 841.084 requires the SVP to pay an amount that TECO determines will be necessary to defray the cost of providing housing, treatment, and service with respect to that person. Money collected under this section is deposited to the credit of the accounts from which the costs were paid. So this is for the SVP's personal expenses, not public use. But even if the court were to find that this were for public use, Mattson is receiving compensation in the form of room and board and the therapy that he's receiving. Courts have expanded the reach of takings clause claims beyond eminent domain, but they've never expanded it to include this type of claim, a statutory requirement that a class of people contribute towards expenditures that are used for their own benefit. So this would be an expansion of takings clause law. And significantly, even if Mattson could show a taking, it is not an unconstitutional taking unless it is without compensation, and Mattson here is compensated. Turning to the rule challenges, and I actually first want to address an issue that has already been discussed and is thematic throughout these pleadings, and that's this notion that the TECO board can't make rules and then McLean instead is obligated to make rules. And this is not supported by the statute. The Texas Civil Commitment Office is a state agency, according to Government Code 420A.022. The Texas Government Code defines the term state agency as a state officer, board, commission, or department with statewide jurisdiction. Therefore, under the Government Code's definition, the Texas Civil Commitment Office board is a state agency. McLean, who is an employee of the agency, is not. Therefore, McLean has neither the obligation nor the statutory authority to make rules for TECO. And I see my time is up, and I will
Can I ask you one question before you
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And we hadn't had a chance to talk to Mr. Marshall about it, but they're making what I consider as an ex post facto argument that, you know, the law changed after he was, his sentence or his commitment. What is your position as to, I understand that the law allows it, what is your position as to whether it can retroactively apply to somebody?
Your Honor, there are, and again, well, starting with the actual Senate Bill 420B requires that the commitment order imposed, if a commitment order imposed under 841 before the effective date differs from the new requirements, the judgment will be reformed. Several claims regarding this have been addressed by the Beaumont Court of Appeals, N. Ray May being one of them, and that is discussed in my briefing. I believe that N. Ray Thomas also discusses that. And the idea is that this is a civil requirement, and this isn't a criminal punishment. So that's one reason given. Another reason given is that these are civil commitment requirements, but even under the old law and under the old version of the commitment order that people were given, there was always this requirement that the office and the law can change the requirements. The old version of 841 point, I guess it's 081, I believe, or 082, still says that the requirements may be changed. And therefore, it's always been part of the program. And in terms of the specific living arrangement part, that there has always been a provision that their living arrangements are subject to change and are subject to TECO's determination.
Thank you,
Your Honors.
I'd like to start at the end of that and go backwards. In Chapter 840, or in Section Senate Bill 746 from 2015, Section 40 required the committing court to go back and amend requirements that had been imposed upon the person that were no longer consistent with changes made in Senate Bill 746 to Section 841.082 of Chapter 841. It did not give the district court the authority to go back and change any requirements other than those imposed in 841.082A, which are the requirements required or that have to be placed in the order of commitment.
Are you talking about the tiered part? Is this where the tiered system comes in? No.
Under Section 841.081, when a person is civilly committed, the judge issues a judgment.
Right.
Under 082, the judge issues an order of commitment.
Right.
There's a list of them,
right,
which used to be 8 or 9 of them, now it's only 4 or 5 of them. They changed in 2015. The legislature threw out.
And that's where they got rid of the one court doing them all? Is that the same thing?
Same time, yes.
Okay.
So when they changed the requirements that had to be included in the order of commitment, mm-hmm, that's what they told the committing court to go back and change. Mm-hmm. They didn't give the district court the authority to change anything else, especially imposing the obligation to pay for treatment and housing. The instruction to the district court was very focused and very limited. Only change the requirements that were imposed in the order of commitment.
But isn't the committing court the court of continuing jurisdiction over
the committing court issue
anyway?
Had not been resolved at that time. It has been. Now it's clear the legislature intends the committing court to be the one that entered the judgment and maintains continuing jurisdiction throughout
the judgment of commitment or the judgment of conviction? There's two different
judgment,
things, right?
Committing court now will be the court where the person was most recently convicted of their sexually violent
convicted
offense.
That's why I was asking. Right. Okay.
So, but the committing court, for purposes of prior to 2015, all stays in the 435th
Correct.
In Montgomery County.
Correct.
So, okay. In 2015, when the legislature changed the statute, that language only applied to the 435th.
I see.
So,
okay.
Judge Seiler, go back and change the orders of commitment that you issued before September 1st of 2015. We're not giving you the authority to go back and change, impose any additional obligations on them. Just modify the requirements that had been imposed so they're consistent with this new law. Making it consistent with the new law meant throwing out four of the previous required requirements, not imposing any new additional requirements.
But did not have the discretion to put anything new in.
Correct.
Or it was not incumbent upon them to do anything new either, per the statute.
I'm sorry, I don't understand your question.
Keep going. You're saying they could only delete.
Yes, that's okay. All they did in 2015 was delete. They didn't add any new. Well, yeah, in Section 841.082, they did not add anything new in there. With respect to retroactive statutes can't impose, the reason for them is to prohibit the imposition of new burdens and obligations on someone. When the obligations had been imposed on Mr. Mattson for purposes of his civil commitment, that became res judicata because the judgment denied any burden, any additional relief that the state might have asked for or might ask for in the future. The definition of state agency under the government code is correct, was quoted correctly up to a point. It actually defines a state agency as board, blah, 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 with statewide jurisdiction that makes rules or decides contested cases. The board governing Texas Civil Commitment Office doesn't make rules, doesn't have any statutory authority to make rules, and does not decide contested cases. In fact, there aren't even any rules for contested cases for the Civil Commitment Office. So to say that the board is an agency for purposes of Government Code 2001.004 is mistaken on that basis, as well as the fact that 841.141 specifically says the office, meaning the Texas Civil Commitment Office, shall administer this program by rule. And from 2015 to 2017, it was required, the office was specifically required to adopt a certain set of rules. The legislature demonstrated the ability and understanding of how to go about giving rulemaking authority to governing boards by what they did with the Texas Board of Criminal Justice. The Texas Board of Criminal Justice governs the Texas Department of Criminal Justice. The Texas Board of Criminal Justice has rulemaking authority. The Texas Department of Criminal Justice does not have rulemaking.
So who should have made, in your opinion, who should have made the rules?
The executive director and her staff should have come up with the rule, should have posted it in the Texas Register, should have waited for public comment. Once it got public comment, they should have adopted the rule. And the board governing the Texas Civil Commitment Office should have made sure that they did that, because it was the office's duty and obligation under the statute to do that. Going back to, in looking at Mr. Mattson's intent with his allegations and his interpreting the allegations liberally, he does raise in three different occasions in the second amended petition the fact that he's been denied due process. We think that the taking of his money without due process is encompassed within his allegation, that is an allegation of a constitutional violation, that he's had his money taken away from him without due process. And whether he got all the process that he was due when he was civilly committed, that applies to the state as well. The state can't come back and, like in an automobile case, the plaintiff can't come back after he's figured out, oh, I didn't ask for enough medical expenses to cover my future medical expenses. Oh, hey, judge, by the way, I need more medical expenses to cover my medical expenses.
How would you address or suggest that this court write the opinion in a manner consistent with what you're looking for and still pay attention to In Re State, because that seems to have resolved a number of the issues adversely to you.
In Re State, the only issue in that case was whether Mr. Brown was entitled to an attorney during his amendment, his what they call the due process hearing. His claim was that because I'm going to be taken out of a halfway house where I have lots of liberty, I can go out in the community, I can go to the law library, I can go to my doctor, I can go to the grocery store without any supervision other than my GPS monitor, and I'm going to be stuck in a repurposed private prison 30 miles northwest of Lubbock.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying it's just not, it's apples to oranges then?
Yes. Okay. And for that purpose, for that issue, now I think the important thing that does apply to this case is that the Supreme Court said that Mr. Brown has a liberty in not being put into inpatient treatment, which is one of the other complaints that Mr. Watson has. He was in outpatient treatment. His judgment says he should get outpatient treatment. There's no provision in the law for amending that judgment. The Supreme Court has said a trial court can't go back and amend a judgment once it loses plenary jurisdiction. So his judgment says outpatient treatment. He's being denied outpatient treatment by the executive director of the Civil Commitment Office because the tiered treatment program that she has been implementing until May 1st, because she fired the treatment providers and hasn't got a new curriculum yet, provided in Tier 5 for outpatient treatment. So her program has an outpatient segment. Mr. Mattson's judgment says outpatient treatment. According to the Texas Supreme Court, Mr. Mattson must also have a liberty interest in being free from inpatient treatment. So, and I wish you had been witness to some of those due process hearings, there was absolutely no evidence about the new treatment program, just that the people would be benefit from additional treatment, not what that treatment was going to be that they would get or what additional treatment they need, just they need more treatment and they'll benefit from more treatment, and this is the only one we've got. So there wasn't any due process, which was the basis of the ruling in the trial court in In Re May, when Judge Ryder said there's no process due here because there's only one outcome. They go to the Littlefield. That's not when the legislature dictates the outcome of the proceedings, that process is not due. Not the due process that anybody's should be accorded under our system of government.
Can I ask you one last question? Do you also agree that the breach of contract, your client's breach of contract, and civil rights claim of peaceful assembly, those have not been addressed by this order and they're still alive in the district?
I agree that they have not been addressed by this order,
okay,
by the judgment that we're here on. There was one other thing. With respect to indigency status changing, that doesn't happen at the whim of an agency. Due process requires some finding by a judicial officer that the person is no longer indigent. Even in the case cited by the Civil Commitment Office and Ms. McLean, that to the effect that indigence can change from the trial of a criminal case to the appeal of a criminal case, they had a hearing and the judge made a finding that, oh, you're not indigent. That hasn't happened in this case. Just TICO, the Civil Commitment Office, and executive director just decided, whoa, well, you've got $5 this month, so 33% and a third percent of that's ours.
What about the argument, though, that there's already that sliding scale that's in place here, and that if Mr.
Madsen.
Madsen makes $0. He owes $0.
Any income? I'm not sure that I understand the sliding, the importance of the sliding scale. It seems to me like the issue is whether whatever.
I'm just asking you to address their argument. And that if they're saying that the agency has already accounted for that by saying if you make no money, you owe no money this month.
I don't see how that changes the fact that if he has money or has anything, gets anything of value, because that's the actual rule. It's not just money. If somebody in the Texas Civil Commitment Center gets a care package from home, it has to come with an itemized invoice in it from the third part, the approved third party supplier, showing the value of the goods in the box and the value of the shipping. If there's not a money order or a check in the box with 33% of the value of the goods in the box and 33% of the value of the shipping, the box doesn't get delivered. Just because they haven't provided their 33 1/3% of their income, which is that box. So if they get a phone card from home for $10, 33 1/3 cents has to accompany that so that the phone card can be given to the resident. And just my final point on indigence, Mr. Madsen is indigent for purposes of this lawsuit. He's being treated as indigent in the trial court and in this court. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to turn briefly to the rule challenge claims that were discussed primarily in the first half of the previous argument. And I'd like to point out to the court that although there has been some talk about some specific rules regarding indigency, in Madsen's live pleading, his second amended complaint, the first cause of action says that the proclamations which address cost recovery were not enacted by TECO, they were enacted by the board responsible to govern TECO and are therefore invalid. And that's on page 97 of the record. Turning to the third amended complaint, it's even more explicit that his entire challenge is based on the fact that TECO has made these, the board has made these rules and not McLean. He says that these rules were enacted by the board, which has no rulemaking authority and are therefore invalid. So I will address the individual rule challenges briefly, but I just wanted to point to the court's attention that this, what's really in front of the court here is this notion that TECO can't make rules, or the board can't make rules, and that McLean must make rules. And in his cause of action, that's what he asked this court to declare, is that these rules are invalid because they were enacted by the wrong entity. But turning to the actual rules, he names 810.122, which is the definition of income. 810.5 is the definition of income. 810.122.6 is the definition of indigency, which seems to be where his real issue is. And that is the rule that defines indigent as someone who has no money. And then 810.273, and I wanted to briefly address this because that's essentially a restatement of the statute. The parts of that rule that place obligations on Madsen are contained in 841.084 of the Texas Health and Safety Code. And therefore, it's not the rule. It is the statute that's placing that place the obligations on Madsen, and therefore it's not a proper subject of a rule challenge claim. And in order to show that a rule is invalid, Madsen must show that the rule impairs or threatens to impair a legal right or privilege. In other words, the rule has to be shown to be inconsistent with the statute or the Constitution. And he really doesn't do this for any of these rules. Turning to the definition of indigency, which is the only one where he kind of purports to make the showing, his whole argument is based on It's the definition of indigency is inconsistent with his with the court's ruling. And he says that the court has declared him indigent for purposes of 841. And so I wanted to turn the court's attention to the documents in the record at page 179 through 181. And this shows that the indigency determination is purely for purposes of the civil action, the civil commitment action. And the only time when he's actually declared indigent by the court is for purposes of court-appointed counsel. Nowhere does it say for purposes of the entire chapter 841 he's indigent. Another version of this claim is that he says that the definition in 841.084, or in the rule, I'm sorry, is inconsistent with 841.005. But there is no definition in 841.005, so it can't be inconsistent. And again, as discussed, you must be indigent for the specific item. He's even been declared not to be indigent in at least one proceeding. And he's not indigent for all purposes and all times just because he was indigent for one purpose and one time. And I see that I'm running out of time. I'll very briefly turn to the ultra-virus claims. Mattson just gives a laundry list of items. I believe there's 13 actions that he claims that are ultra-virus that McLean has done. A lot of them have to do with this rulemaking argument that we've already discussed. But even where they're not, these are not, he doesn't make any specific allegations that are sufficient to state an ultra-virus claim against McLean. An ultra-virus claim has to show that McLean has a duty that's defined with such precision and certainty as to leave nothing to the exercise of discretion or judgment. So you can see many of these claims are based on things that are purely discretionary, such as the idea that she's not providing, the treatment she is providing isn't appropriate.
Well, arguably 1 through 6 go to the money.
And yes,
if
Your
the
Honor.
Rules aren't properly enacted, her assessment of these fees, that's why I was asking, so your ultra-virus claims are kind of predicated on there being no rules in effect.
Yes, Your Honor.
So if the rulemaking I don't know that there's a question in there other than, I guess, if the rulemaking procedures fail in this court's opinion, then I guess those first 6 ultra-vires, wouldn't they be resolved necessarily?
Well, Your Honor, I think they would be resolved in terms of the rulemaking claim. However, it would be a redundant remedy at that point, so okay. It still wouldn't be an ultra-virus claim. And, Your Honor, just briefly in conclusion, Tico and McLean ask that this court affirm in part and reverse in part the trial court's judgment in accordance with our briefing.
Can I ask a question?
Thank you.
So
absolutely.
I understand. What is your position as to their argument that, you know, the board does not have rulemaking power, that was granted to TECO, and that these are two separate entities?
Your Honor, let me go back to the language that I cited. The government code specifically says the Texas Civil Commitment Office is the state agency. They named TECO is the named state agency. They also say the office by rule shall administer this chapter in 841.141, but the office is also defined in the Texas Health and Safety Code as the Texas Civil Commitment Office, which has been previously defined by the government code as the state agency. And as a state agency, Texas government code defines the term an officer, board, commission, or department with statewide jurisdiction. And so I don't think it's in dispute that there's statewide jurisdiction here. The argument that because they don't make rules, they're not, that's a circular argument. And therefore, the state agency is TECO, and TECO's the one who's able to make rules. And there's been no authority provided for the notion that McLean is the person who should make rules, or I think he mentioned Jessica Marsh as well. These are employees of the agency. There's no precedent that he cited or any case law or any statute that says that an employee of an agency can make rules for the agency. Thank you.
Thank you. Anything else? Okay. And with that, the case will be submitted and this court is adjourned.
Thank you.
All please rise.